Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Culture Heritage Fund. Live from the University of Minnesota, you are listening to Radio K's Culture Q, the Twin Cities arts and cultural program providing you the stories of Minnesota that you won't hear anywhere else. I'm your host, Matthew Curtis, and thank you so much for joining us. This week we're talking to people who are trying to find their place. Whether it be an independent artist in a saturated music industry, a person struggling with his or her emotions, looking to art for healing, or an athlete in an unpopular sport. Aaron Bolton listens to local independent bands, Amy Freeman talks with painters who are trying to look up, and Alex Furness tries his hand at curling. And it starts right now on Radio K's Culture Q. Independent music, or indie music for short, can be defined as music independently produced from the major record labels, using a DIY approach. But in reality, this is an oversimplification of a pretty complex process. Music reporter Aaron Bolton chatted to a couple of local artists who are doing it the hard way. And at night I see us back to back.
My name is Nick Pulowski. I'm the bass player.
I'm Ben. I play guitar.
I'm Jack, and I sing and play guitar.
I'm Jake, and I play the drums.
So what does it mean to be an independent band, guys?
It means you got to do it all yourself. There isn't much out there that's going to help you other than your pride and work, ambition, everything like that. You know, work ethic is huge.
Nobody's holding your hands.
Yeah.
It's all on you.
Well, the guys from the Modern Era put it simply. I wanted to see if there was another group or artist out there that held the same ideal. I also spoke with Minneapolis-based singer-songwriter Joey Frascazzi to see what he thought about being independent as well.
Just a general overview, what does it mean to be an independent band?
I don't know, man. I mean, in the industry today, I feel like being independent could mean quite a few different things. I book all of our shows, I book all of our tours, I have a publicist.
So, you might be thinking, he has a publicist, he can't be independent, you have to do it all yourself, right? Well, not exactly. Just because you're independent doesn't mean you can't get help, but it's not free either.
I have an arrangement with them where it's technically independent because there's like a form of payment that happens for that work then.
Frascazzi still does most of his own work for his band and has to outsource a few tasks to be able to keep up. The more he outsources, the less he makes on his record. The Modern Era, on the other hand, is a group project. More hands on deck means less outsourcing.
Ben and Jake do a lot of the booking side of things. I do a lot of the video and Nick runs the website and a lot of the social media and the promo.
The Modern Era takes a different approach from Frascazzi, and each member has a job to do. To start breaking all this down, we'll start with booking shows.
We're just, you know, either hitting up people we know to help us get shows at places we've played before or know people at, or shooting out, you know, cold phone calls, cold emails to people that have no idea you exist and hoping that they at least listen to you and give you a chance.
I've done some work with a local booking agent. His name is Flip Arcularry. We put out our album Lemonheart, which is the first full-length album, in November 2013. And so since then, we've been touring. And the first tour we did, he helped book a few of those shows. And, you know, it was independent because he was taking a cut from it, you know. So it was like, again, there was some sort of form of payment happening. And since then, I've just booked everything by myself.
Frascazzi mentioned touring in his booking process for his first tour after the Lemonheart record. How does an independent band go on tour? As Modern Era mentioned, a lot of it involves sending out emails in the hopes they say yes. But that doesn't always happen. Then there's gas, food, lodging, and most of all, getting paid enough by the clubs to make this all happen.
What's the step-by-step process to make your own tour happen as an independent band?
The main thing is you'll have a couple big, nice shows on your tour run that help pay for all the shows that don't pay you really anything at all. So we always try to line up like one show in Minneapolis right before we leave and one show in our hometown of Rochester right when we get back. So we have some guaranteed good money shows that can kind of help us support ourselves while we're out on the road. A lot of times we're trying to reach bands from the towns we want to, you know, explore and try to do show trades, so we at least have some people to play to and some people to push our name down there. Otherwise, without help, like, you can get stuck playing to no one for nothing.
Ben of the Modern Era also says this is the way most well-known bands set up their tours as well. To go on tour, the bands need material. They also want to make money selling their merchandise, t-shirts, buttons, stickers, and most of all, their music. To make those CDs is another story, and a whole nother process. There are many ways bands can go about this process, and studio time rates can vary.
I've heard of studios in Minneapolis that charge, you know, an hourly rate, or a day rate, or whatever it is.
To record a record, you need a producer, and this is where the money situation plays a big factor. There are many ways to go about this process, and Frascazzi works with a producer named Isaac Burkhart. They work on a point system known as working on spec. The producer takes points off the record, and the more points taken off the record, the more the producer makes on royalties and record sales. This does seem simple, but deals can vary based on if the producer owns the studio or if they're willing to take the risk of working on spec in the first place.
Because working on spec is really a risk because you don't know that you're going to get the money back.
So if the producer decides not to work on spec, there are other arrangements that can be made.
An arrangement would be where the producer will take less points off the master, less points on the back end, and charge somewhat of a fee up front so that they are getting some money to, like, pay for the studio, to pay for their time.
Then comes mixing and mastering, each process coming with its own cost, chipping away at what the artist makes on the record. Finally, the record is ready to be pressed. The Modern Era pays a flat fee for their releases, while Frascazzi has the help of indie label Princess Records. His deal with the label bundles CD pressing along with publicity.
They did a radio campaign for us, and that was at, you know, at no cost because we're on the label. And
once again, you may be thinking independent bands cannot be on a record label, but there are independent labels out there. Indie labels differ because they don't give artists money to make the record. Frascazzi and his producer make the record with their own money. The label helps with limited things such as pressing records and publicity. As we have seen, there are many different ways independent bands can go about the music industry. And these band stories are just the surface of the indie music business. For Culture Q, I'm Aaron Bolton.
Here I have music reporter for Culture Q, Aaron Bolton, ready to talk about his story. So, why did you feel like these people needed to have their, you know, like their stories told?
They both have different perspectives from where they're coming from, far as the independent music scene goes. When you listen to this music, I don't know, sometimes I get more enjoyment knowing out of it, knowing it's an independent band. But it's also, they're jack of all trades. So they have to know how to do so much besides just make good music. So,
I mean, do you feel like they're independent out of necessity, or do you feel like it's a choice?
You know, Joey put it to me this way. He said, you know, he wouldn't know what to do if he was presented with the opportunity. If a major label came along and said, hey, here's 200 grand, you know, quit your job for 6 months, go away and make a record. He really doesn't know what he would do in that situation. So, you know, for him, someone at his level, maybe that's, you know, he may approach that, run into that situation soon. I think the Modern Era, maybe they might be doing it out of necessity. They've had opportunities, I know, in the past. So it might be choice, you know. I really don't know. That's a good question.
I see. I mean, I don't know the story of Joey Frascazzi and the Modern Era. Are they full-time musicians, or do they have other jobs?
Joey Frascazzi is. Modern Era guys, they do all have day jobs.
I mean, do you think it changes the way in which they do business in terms of whether they're full-time or part-time musicians?
Yeah. You know, and another thing is these two bands differ just because Joey, he does have a band behind him, but it is more of a solo project. So, like, in the story, you know, hear about kind of him outsourcing things. And, you know, the Modern Era, they split up their responsibilities because they're, you know, an all-hands-on-deck kind of affair. And yeah, and I think it does affect the way they do business. You know, they really have to look out for their best interests, and they really have to weigh whether, you know, I wouldn't say publicity, but, you know, exposure. They have to weigh exposure versus, you know, cost, because, like, you know, they were talking about the tour aspect of things, and they have to have two shows to pay for most of the shows that won't pay anything at all. So yeah, I mean, I think it really does affect the way they do stuff.
What do you think the actual goals of these musicians are? Who, you know, are they trying to make a quick buck, or are they like just trying to do it for the music?
I believe both these guys, both Modern Era and Frascati, they're in it for the music, and that's another thing I personally do like about independent bands. It more seems like it's about the music. It's not just, you know, go make a hit record and let's get rich. I know their goals are to be professional musicians, and I know like Jack from Modern Era has done it somewhat professionally for a while. He's had different bands and you know, Joey as well. And they're all about the music, but they do want to make a living as well. They love it so much that they want to make a living. I don't think they're trying to be, you know, Led Zeppelin or anything, but they do want to make a living at it. They would rather not go to the pizza store every day and deliver pizzas. I'm sure they'd much rather be playing guitars and playing good music for an audience.
I think the sacrifices they make for the music and, you know, the method in which they do it is noble. And I think, you know, as you were saying, independent music deserves a lot of respect. So, good job on the story, Aaron.
Thank you, man.
Art can be a means of expression, distraction, therapy, and for those at Bridgeview Art Program, it can be a way to reclaim one's identity. Producer Amy Freeman talks with some people in this program who defy stigma, define themselves not by their mental illness, but by their art.
Kim Olsen's brushstrokes are as soothing as her mellow disposition.
What's this one about?
Kind of the light and dark of how you feel. And the woman, I'm going to have her in the center, and it's almost going to look a little bit like a cave.
You would never guess it, but she suffers from bipolar disorder. Art is one way that she has been able to communicate this experience to others.
And I might have her arms up, like she's kind of surrendering and also being happy about life.
Two of her paintings are hung up in Bridgeview, a drop-in center for adults living with serious and persistent mental illness. Most of the people at the center right now keep coming back for one thing, their art program.
I have been coming to Bridgeview since 2009. Changed my life.
Jill Ness had been struggling with back problems, severe depression, and postpartum depression after the birth of her daughter.
So my life consisted of a series of doctor's appointments, whether it was the doctor, the psychiatrist, the back surgeon, you know, everything.
But she had never thought to look outside of an office, to art therapy.
I actually had a RISE worker who dared me to come here. I found out I was actually good at art. Before I just thought art was kind of hoity-toity and you had to have training and all this, and, you know, and I didn't do that in college.
She hadn't practiced art before, but she had shown interest from an early age.
I was in a humanities class in high school, and we had to do a report, and I came across Vincent van Gogh's Crows with Wheatfields, and it was painted a few days before he committed suicide. And I wanted to know the story, and I just loved the textured strokes and everything, and then those crows coming in a line were just so foreboding, and I thought the painting was so strong, and I loved it, even though it was depressing.
Of course, there are other artists and writers who suffered from mental illness. Poe, Hemingway, Picasso, even Michelangelo. So many that we know this trope well, the tortured artist. But is there really anything behind this? Ness has been doing her own research on the relationship between mental illness and creativity.
I think there is a relationship with creativity, but I don't think people are creative necessarily because of their mental illness, but I think that their mental illness provides them to see those extremes of life that come out so beautifully in art. And also because dealing with mental illness on a daily basis, you really have to become resilient. And I think that resilience is what brings out their creativity.
But I can tell that Ness is getting tired of this line of questioning. She says, our tendency to romanticize mental illness in art is kind of insulting.
The biggest thing I want people to realize is not to romanticize mental illness. Don't think, oh my gosh, this work is great, and did you know the artist has mental illness? You know, because it lessens it to something, you know? I would rather have them just love the art and just, you know, find out on the side that they struggle with mental illness.
And the program has found that people do love the art, so much so that many of the artists at Bridgeview have sold their pieces, and you can find them in various coffee shops and art showings around the Twin Cities. Their art has allowed them to communicate their stories in ways they could have never otherwise. For example, James Ross, who's been attending the Bridgeview art program for about 2 years now, recently sold a piece for $400. He best sums up what art has done for him in a poem.
Celebration of art. My art is passion, deep from inside. My art is my heartbeat, my vision, and very own eyes. My art is given, a talent helping me grow. My art is reason for spreading my wings and letting go. My art is a tempest, yet peaceful calmness. My art is a graceful balance from which my fires dance. My art is courage to persevere through ominous times. My art is a challenge structured to shape and refine. My art is connection with purpose to bind. My art is a journey through body, soul, and mind. My art is my dedication, a path learned to recognize. My art is my prosperity, a blessing bestowed to life. Thank you very much.
For Culture Q, I'm Amy Friedman.
Every week, Radio K selects one album to highlight, and this week we have selected Always' self-titled debut as our weekly release spotlight. To read a full review of the album and download a free track, head to RadioK.org. From Always, this is Archie, Marry Me. Once again, that was Archie Marry Me by Always from their self-titled debut on Radio K's Coach Q. You can check out the full review of the album as well as a free track on RadioK.org. On our list of winter sports, curling doesn't often get a place at the top, and is often misconceived. But with so much local talent and potential, reporter Alex Furness goes to visit the University of Minnesota Curling Club to see if curling will one day sweep away the competition.
Curling, it's played on ice. You have a circle of rings on the far side of the sheet of ice, and it's called the house. And the object of the game is to try to get your rocks to the closest in the center of the house.
Each game will consist of somewhere between 8 and 10 ends, and an end is kind of analogous to an inning in baseball.
4 people are on the ice at a time, and then you have a skip, who's kind of the strategist of the game, and they call the shots, and they also throw the last 2 rocks of the end.
30 minutes away from campus, a small group of students are practicing their game. This is the University of Minnesota Curling Club, and they have earned their place amongst the best curlers in the nation in their first 2 years. As team member John Tyson was pleased to tell me.
The curling team at the U of M has done pretty well in last year. We made it to nationals, and we did very well there. We won, and we're hoping to repeat that this year. We got invited back this year, and it'll be in mid-March up in the Blaine Four Seasons Curling.
But they didn't begin their career as champions, especially Rachel Guez.
When I started curling, my brother started before I did a few years, and I thought it was really weird because I had never heard of it before. So I made fun of him for a little while, and then I actually went to go try it out and decided it was pretty cool. So I got into it in high school and then continued into college.
The sport of curling has many misconceptions, especially about the yelling and sweeping.
A lot of the shouting comes from judging the weight of a stone, which is very difficult to do, actually, and it's very important to the game because the person that throws the rock controls the direction and the weight to some extent, but you're never going to have a really, really good shot without the help of the rest of the team.
Yeah, the sweeping is really important to the game, actually, because when you sweep, it creates a thin sheet of water on the ice, which reduces the friction, making the rock go farther and straighter. So if you don't sweep as much, it won't go as far and it'll curl more. So if your shot isn't quite perfect, because it rarely is, the sweeping will help get right where you want it.
The reason there are so many misconceptions about curling is because of its lack of popularity in the United States.
It's not really a sport that it gets televised or a lot of publicity, not on TV, like ever. You gotta go online to watch it usually.
However, the perception of curling is quite different to our northern neighbor.
Curling is sort of ingrained in part of our culture up here.
The sport of curling is extremely popular in Canada. As the GM of Royal Canadian Curling Club, Bill McAnally explains.
The community sort of revolves around the curling club. You know, everyone goes to the curling club because that's sort of the social center of the town, maybe in the winter.
In some parts of Canada, the popularity of curling is comparable to that of hockey and American football.
You get into like your rural communities in Canada, and you can almost compare it to football, high school football down in the United States, where, you know, these small communities sort of revolve around their high school team.
The popularity of curling is so big, it is even shown on their main sports network.
We have TSN. And they brought, when the Canadian Championships are on for both the men and women, they'll show, it'll be on 3 times a day.
With the Olympics just ending and the Canadians' recent success, the interest in curling has even grown more.
It's just really busy. Everyone wants to try it. And what's great about it, and again, I think it's because of the Olympics, it's an audience that wants to try it that really maybe hasn't seen it before, really hadn't given it a second thought, but because it's in the Olympics, hey, I want to try this.
The Olympics has also sparked interest in curling in other parts of the globe, including the United States.
I think it's gotten a lot more popularity recently, especially with the Olympics season. It's been helping it out. But you see a lot more ice that's dedicated to curling springing up around different areas of a lot of the Midwest.
With an increase in awareness and publicity of curling in the U.S., will it soon be able to compete with other winter sports like it has in Canada?
It's really hard to say about the future direction of the sport in the U.S., but I think by just getting more people out to try it and see if just how the competitive aspect of it progresses, it would be interesting to see if we ever could get to a level similar to Canada and our publicity of it and just the dedication to the sport.
This is Alex Vernetz reporting for Radio K Culture Q.
You've been listening to Culture Q on Radio K, hearing every Sunday at 6 p.m. bringing you all the stories of the Twin Cities that you won't hear anywhere else. Tonight you heard the voices of Aaron Bolton, Amy Friedman, Alex Vernetz, and Matthew Curtis. Our producer Amy Friedman, Parker Lemke, and Katie Bolin. Our music reporter is Aaron Bolton. Our culture coach is Cyril Lemanchek, and I'm host and managing editor Matthew Curtis. You can find us on RadioK.org, PRX, and iTunes. You can join us on Facebook, just search Culture Q. Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Culture Heritage Fund. See you next Sunday at 6 p.m. Thank you for listening.